Coming to you from the heart of the Diocese of Savannah, this is the return of It's Catholic, y'all. After some time of being away, we are excited to relaunch this series of conversations about faith and life. Views expressed in this podcast do not necessarily represent the views of the Diocese of Savannah.
As Dr. Carl Haas used to say when he introduced his radio program, Pipe Dreams, hello everyone. I'm Father Michael Cavanaugh, pastor of St. Peter the Apostle Church on Wilmington Island, and I'm here with Father Alan MacDonald, who is a recently retired priest of our diocese.
I've been retired for about a year and a half now, and my last assignment in the diocese was at St. Anne's in Richmond Hill.
And I'm a native of Savannah. I was born when we lived in Thunderbolt. I went to school for 22 years, all of it in Catholic schools, from kindergarten at Blessed Sacrament through Blessed Sacrament School, Benedictine Military School, Belmont Abbey College, University of Notre Dame for grad school, and then Mount St. Mary's Seminary in Emmitsburg, where I studied theology and received my master's degree in systematic theology. We've been writing in the last couple of issues of the Southern Cross about some contemporary issues, and one of the things that I wrote about was the whole idea of transhumanism, and you wrote about the possibility of aliens, and how do aliens enter into our understanding of the economy of salvation. Can you tell us a little bit about what you said in that article?
Well, I spoke about it from a theoretical point of view as well as from maybe a theological point of view, and I think that we have to start with the bottom line that the Church has no teaching on extraterrestrial life, whether it exists or not. But we're free to speculate on that, whether it's, you know, just bacteria of some kind or really intelligent life, perhaps more intelligent than us. And I think in the United States and all around the world, there's always been a fascination with aliens, with Martians. Recently, I watched again the 1950s movie War of the Worlds, which I was happy to see at the end of it. There was kind of a religious component as people were flocking to churches knowing that the end was near, and then some miracle occurs where the aliens die because of the human bacteria on Earth that kills them, and that brings them into the conflict. But we're always interested in extraterrestrial life. Superman is a good example, but then also the evil side of that, of Martians and other aliens coming in and taking over Earth and destroying the life that is already here. The question is, if there is intelligent life, perhaps even more intelligent than us, visiting us here on Earth, and therefore they probably are more intelligent if they can get from their location, which we don't know where they are, here rather quickly. What is their experience of being created? What do they believe in terms of God? Has God intervened in their salvation history, so to speak, as he has done so in our own salvation history? And if there are aliens in our midst, and they're friendly and they're like us but smarter, how do we evangelize them? Do they have an experience of original sin, an actual sin? So those are questions that I find interesting. I don't think that we can settle them in a definitive way. But then I also wrote that we believe that there are other beings that have been here. Saint Gabriel the Archangel visited our Blessed Mother. Our Blessed Mother has visited us here on Earth, and there are approved revelations of her here, private revelations that the Church approves of. And so we know that we have encountered the redeemed here on Earth, be it angels, good or bad, whether it be the Blessed Mother or some other saint, or even Jesus Christ himself making an appearance here after the resurrection. And certainly God Almighty, in the person of Jesus Christ, one divine being with two natures, human and divine, was here for a specific period of time in the flesh until his passion, death, resurrection, and ascension. So this idea of other beings, supreme or human or otherwise, is really, I think, a part of the Church's teachings.
One of my favorite science fiction movies was The Andromeda Strain, written by Michael Crichton, the book and the movie as well, and they encountered a life form that looked nothing like us. We often see in science fiction movies when the alien steps out of the spaceship, it's got two arms, two legs, two eyes, or some form very similar to that. If you think about the robots in War of the Worlds, or you think about E.T., they looked an awful lot like us, but it might be true that there are life forms that we wouldn't recognize as life forms. We simply don't look for things like that. In the Andromeda strain, it was a microscopic life form that was something like a virus, but something like a crystalline structure, and they had no idea that they were looking at something that was alive. They discovered that in the process and managed to stop it before it destroyed the world. It is a lot of speculation when you talk about what might be out there, and that does, as you say, that's fine. Does this other life form need salvation? We simply don't know. We haven't been told that. Revelation leads us or offers us what we need to know for our own salvation. We don't have to worry about the salvation of others until we encounter them and find out what their needs might be.
And Father Kavanaugh, you wrote on the topic of transhumanism, which I had really never given a whole lot of thought to, which is a movement incorporating genetic engineering, artificial intelligence, and other forms of technology into the body of the person. And what did you have to say about that?
I can't say an awful lot about artificial intelligence. We've all been hearing about it constantly on the radio and television these days. Just yesterday or the day before, there was a meeting in Washington, D.C. of the heads of some of the major corporations that are involved in artificial intelligence, trying to help our legislators understand what kind of regulations might be needed. Again, that's something that's way beyond me. I will say, though, that one of our deacon candidates brought in a little daily mass sermon that he had produced using ChatGPT, and it was actually very, very good. I was a little bit scared. I thought it was going to be kind of worthless, but it was rather good altogether. The one that has really interested me, that area that's really interested me more than any others, has been the genetic engineering, because that's something that is happening right now and actually has been happening for several decades. When we talk about altering our human genetic code, we're talking about making changes that may or may not be passed on. When we talk about altering our genetic code, we're talking about changing something that makes us who we are as a specific individual, not just as a human, but as a specific individual. Most folks may be aware that it was a priest, Father Gregor Mendel, who discovered that there was some kind of physical trait that was passed on from parent generation to child generation. He had no idea what it was, but he knew that there was something there. It was a few years after that we began to understand this thing called DNA in the nucleus of a cell, and further, once we had looked into what DNA was, we discovered that was where the genetic code lies. Now, how much of that can you change before you change something from being human to something else? What could you bring in from a different organism altogether and place it in a human genetic code that would render us non-human anymore? We don't know at this point. Some people are concerned that scientists get entirely too carried away, and there's some that do, but one of the things to keep in mind is that when the genetic recombinant gene scientists were first getting started in the late 50s, early 60s, they themselves recognized that what they were doing could have a profound impact on the human person. And it was the scientists who called together the first Asilomar conference in California in 1975. The scientists said, "We can do this, but we've got to look at what the effects might be, what the impact is going to be. Is this something that we can do, but is it therefore something we should do?" And from their work, the scientists, the physicians, and a few press reporters were gathered together. From their work, the National Institutes of Health began to develop guidelines for how we move forward when we start fiddling with changing the genetic code in our bodies. It can have extraordinarily good impacts. We've discovered that we can take portions of our genes that lead to disease or illness, remove them and replace them with healthy portions. And that's just an extraordinary thing, to be able to do that, to eliminate diseases. Wonderful advance. But then there are other things that we have to be much more careful about. The one that I mentioned in the article, I think, was taking genes that produce photosynthetic material, the green of plants. That's how they gain their energy. Plants just lay out in the sun. They don't have to eat anything. They lay out in the sun and their photosynthesis changes the sunlight into the energy that they use to grow. Could we put that in a human being? It would be difficult, certainly. I suppose there have been
how
some scientists who've tried.
Right,
I don't know how many calories there might be or how many it produces, but it might be a replacement for all of the weight loss programs. But genetic engineering, at least as far as direct impact on human individuals is concerned, might be the most pressing issue that we need to deal with.
Well, let me ask you a question, because it raises other ethical issues of, for example, the reverse, that you give human genetic material to an animal,
sure,
say a dog, so that it is able to communicate verbally and act like a human being, although still looking like a dog. What are the implications of that morally?
I think that sort of transposing of human genes into other organisms would be morally very questionable.
Yeah.
This is not a human being. We are not the creators of human beings. And even the Vatican, the Holy See, has said that when we start working in areas of genetic, of recombinant genetics, we have to be very, very careful not to change or adjust those things that give us our human identity. If you have a gene that produces an illness, that's not a part of your human identity. If you have a gene that gives you intelligence, or if you have a gene that gives you the ability to communicate in human speech, are we moving into an area that might be, we would be moving into an area that's certainly more morally questionable. It's something we would have to study a great deal. As I think about it, it would be just physically a very, very difficult thing to do. Everything about our bodies has evolved over millions of years to make this form of communication, this form of thought possible. You wouldn't simply be able to take talking genes and put them in a dog. The dog doesn't have the vocal cords, the dog doesn't have the thinking possibility, but it would be a matter of time before that thing might be developed. It's kind of hard to say.
And the same in terms of prosthetics, so to speak. You know, you speak of artificial limbs and other things, organs that help you to function in a more normal way due to an injury or surgery or whatever. What about placing a chip in one's brain that acts like the internet on your iPhone or iPad or computer and gives you all the intelligence that you need at your fingertips, as well as foreign languages that you might be able to communicate, or others can understand your English in their own language because they have this chip that translates for them? What are the moral implications of that sort of a thing? And the fact that then we can be tracked apart from any devices that we're carrying.
Right. When you implant things in the human body, they should always be for some kind of benefit. That would be kind of the first measure, is this a good thing, is this a bad thing? If we implant something like a chip in the human body for keeping track of you, for instance, in some cases that might be very, very useful. I know people who are suffering from memory loss or dementia, they often wear a bracelet or a necklace that enables their family members to keep an eye on where they are for their benefit. It would be, I think, a benefit for us to be able to hear other languages and understand them. So there are morally, I think, acceptable areas for that kind of work, and some that would be more questionable. If you're talking about simply giving someone an artificial limb, a leg, an arm, if you're talking about implanting an artificial pancreas in someone because their pancreas has stopped working, they need something to produce insulin, those would all be benefits. It depends on how far you go and how much you
yeah,
impede.
What about an artificial ring? You take yours out and give you an artificial brain.
That's an artificial brain?
Well, somebody else's brain.
It's maybe a possibility.
Yeah.
But again, I've read very little about the transplanting of brains, and some of the things I read said it would be medically or physically a rather simple process, but you're taking an entire different human being and placing it in a body that is not theirs, and that would be
an alien from this earth.
It could be. It
yeah,
could be.
Exactly.
Right. What sort of areas, in terms of aliens, did you have any favorite aliens when you were growing up? Did you like Lost in Space like I did?
I did. I loved Lost in Space, and I loved it better than Star Trek. I think it was more children-oriented for me. I always loved Superman and was always fascinated about how he got here and his step-parents making him more human, and I believe, I don't know if it's in the comic book, that I presume he was baptized and brought up in the church and all the rest of that. So that's kind of a fascinating aspect. And I do like science fiction, especially the 1950s movies that are science fiction. There's something about the production values or qualities that I like, that we have people visiting us. And there was a 1960s television show starring Roy Thinnes And now it slips my mind what the name of the show is, but it was about aliens that were here that looked like us, but they were nefarious. And Roy, who was the good guy, was trying to find them and put them to death before he was put to death. The Invaders was the name of that show. It was very, very fascinating. I think we're all fascinated by the possibility of extraterrestrial life being here, and that's been ramped up recently, even in Congress, and by those pilots that have been noticing some unusual spacecrafts or aircrafts that are moving in ways that they've never seen an aircraft move. And those could be certainly created by human beings. It could be a secret, top secret project of our country or Russia or China or whatever. That's even more fearful that they would have a technology that we don't have that could conquer the world, if you will. And I think that's more frightening than science fiction when you see what we can do in terms of travel. I've also been, and this is a little bit of science fiction, but fascinated by time travel. Going back in time or going forward in time, similar to Back to the Future movies that we saw. What are the realms of possibility? Who would have thought that we would have the technology that we have today in terms of social media, the internet, instant communications? And there are many people who think that we have the technology now for all of these fantastic ways to communicate in the world and computer usage and all, from spacecraft that came here and aliens that gave us that technology. And there have been some people in high places in government who have said that is precisely what has happened. I don't know what your reaction would be.
Well, it might be
to
the same people mm-hmm. who want to say that the aliens built the pyramids.
Exactly. That's a good point. Yeah.
There's a popular meme that runs around, and it shows all of these slaves building these pyramids and toiling for decades and decades. Mm-hmm. And they say, people will remember us for what we did. And then they switch to the present time, and a tourist in Cairo is pointing and saying, look what aliens did. You know, it wasn't the aliens at all. It was the slaves who built those pyramids, the slaves who moved stones with massive pulleys and such in order to develop these incredible monuments to death. One of the shows that I enjoyed a great deal, you were talking about time travel, was The Time Tunnel.
Oh, yes.
That was one that might have been the first TV show that was dedicated to people going backwards and forwards mm-hmm. in time and the difficulties. The question that's always raised is, if you go back in time and you change something that happened 40 years ago or 240 years ago, you're going to be changing the present. So there is an ethical question there. Is it ethical to go back and to make a change in the Battle of Waterloo or the Battle of Hastings Field? Is it ethical to go back and make those changes? We probably not. But is this even a possibility moving through time? Certainly isn't right now, but we don't know what's going to happen in the future. Your interest in aliens started with your watching television, and I was, in terms of biology, I got very interested when I was a student at Benedictine. We had a really crazy man teaching us biology, Father Bertrand Dunnigan. Benedictine, he was a magnificent teacher. He loved the classroom work, but even more than that, he loved the outdoor work. He loved ecology, and so we learned to sail. We went beachcombing with him. We learned to paddle canoes with him. We walked all over the Benedictine campus. We made nature trails. He took what we learned in the classroom and then moved it outside and helped us to see that connection. And so in college, I majored in biology and continued in graduate school studying freshwater biology before I made the transition over to seminary. So I've always been very, very grateful to have that background in science as well as a background in theology. Just recently, our provincial gathering in Raleigh, North Carolina was on that very topic, faith, science, and truth. And the speaker there from Notre Dame came down and talked to us about how the two, faith and science, are not at all necessarily opposed to each other. We talked among ourselves, the priests who were there, the bishops who were there, and we decided, or we thought that it would be wise to help some of our students know that in our grade schools and our high schools. They'll start hearing in 7th or 8th grade that if you're a person of science, you can't possibly be a person of faith. Or if you're a person of faith and you have to dismiss all the science in the world, and it's absolutely not true. As I mentioned, Father Gregor Mendel was the father of modern genetics. He was a priest and a scientist. The priest who began the development of the Big Bang Theory was a priest, Father Georges Lemaître, who taught in Belgium. It was an extraordinary effort for him, something that has led to just magnificent advances in astrophysics. But the point being, it's very easy to be a person of science and a person of faith. We don't approach the scriptures as fundamentalists do. That's where I think a lot of the opposition to science comes from. The Bible says 6 days of creation, therefore it must be 6 24-hour days. Well, that's an incorrect reading of the scriptures, but then it has a great rebound effect on how you're going to understand any kind of scientific progress or any kind of scientific experimentation beyond that. So it's an area that has always interested me. People laugh sometimes when they say, well, what did you study in graduate school? I said freshwater biology with an emphasis on freshwater insects, mosquitoes, among other things. I wouldn't trade it for anything in the world. I think it was an excellent background for theology. And as being a pastor, a scientist is nothing more than a well-trained observer. And I think as priests, we do a lot of that. We see what's going on in people's lives, and we try to respond to them in helpful ways.
Well, to be the devil's advocate or devil may play, do you believe in aliens?
I see no reason to believe one way
or
the other.
Here.
I don't think there are any aliens here, unless it's a form that we simply cannot. They might be in this room. Mm-hmm. We just don't know how to recognize those kinds of life forms because we're looking for something that looks like us, that's carbon-based. Who knows what the form might be in another place or another time?
I'm highly skeptical, but I do think it's possible. You know. So what do you think our responsibilities as Catholics, both as clergy and lay people, to address these areas in our lives without falling into either despair or blindly following trends of the world?
The Church has always been countercultural. And in different times, that might mean different things. 600, 800, 1200 years ago, science was not an issue, and the movements of science that might be morally questionable really didn't exist to much degree, if any degree at all. However, in the last 400 years or so, as modern science has really come into its own, we just have to be aware of what's happening. That's the first thing, to understand as much as we can what is going on. You don't have to know the intricacies of artificial intelligence or of recombinant DNA research, but we do have to be aware that this sort of thing is going on in our world, and we want to be aware, first of all, just aware that it's going on. If there's a reason for us to be involved, if we are involved in some kind of research in this area as scientists, as medical practitioners, as biomedical researchers, then as a Catholic, you'd certainly have a greater responsibility to be aware of what's happening. We try not to follow the trends of the world when those trends lead us astray, but there are things that come from the world that can be beneficial to us. As I said, I've always very much enjoyed the fact that I had a science background, and I encounter the presence of God all the time. When I walk in the woods, when I stand at the seashore, when I look at clouds in the sky, when I read about some tremendous advance in biomedical technology, I'm aware of the presence of God that way. You have some thoughts on that?
Well, I would say that there's a lot of unknown with everything that we've spoken about. With AI, I'm not really familiar with what it could do on the evil side. Perhaps it could set off a nuclear war. I don't know. With aliens, if they invaded us and came to destroy us, how do we react to that? And ultimately, our Catholic faith is about having hope in eternal salvation. And if I can go back to the movie, the 1950s movie, The War of the Worlds, at the end of the movie, people were in churches praying as their country and the world was being destroyed by these aliens, and they were probably not looking for a miracle, but eternal salvation, which is what Jesus promises us, that no matter what happens to us, good or bad, our lives will come to an end. There will be the four last things we're going to have to deal with: death, judgment, heaven, or hell. And God gives us the grace to follow his son Jesus, to experience the salvation that he has won for us, the opening of the gates of heaven to us. And that's our ultimate hope, no matter what horrors or science fiction or fact fiction horrors we experience.
Amen. Amen.
This has been an episode of It's Catholic, Y'all. Visit us at diosav.org or on our Diosav social media platforms for more.